Welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, April 18th, 2016. This was the week in which Planned Parenthood President Cecile Richards dismissed claims by Senator Ted Cruz that he was a defender of women. She recycled a previous quote and said, "A woman voting for Ted Cruz is like a chicken voting for Colonel Sanders." Thanks for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your week-to-week host and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, naturally, we're going to be talking about Colonel Sanders and Ted Cruz and all the others in this presidential primary race, plus some state and local elections, police and prison reform, some anti-LGBT laws that are spreading across the South, and other political news. So I always like to point out that the Commonwealth Club includes folks of a wide variety of views. We're a nonpartisan organization, which doesn't mean no one has views here. It means everyone has views here. They're all welcome. So any views that are expressed up here, though, are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Dr. James Taylor. He's the director of African American Studies, and he's a professor of political science at the University of San Francisco. He's not on Twitter yet, by the way. We convinced Dr. Larry Gersten to join Twitter, so you know we'll shame you into it soon. Next to him is Carla Marinucci. She's the political genius behind the Politico California Playbook. And she is on Twitter at C. Marinucci. And next to me is C.W. Nevius, Chuck Nevius. He's a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. He is also on Twitter at C.W. Nevius. So there are question cards spread out throughout the room. I think you all know our shtick here. I write down some questions, send them up, and I will try to ask as many as possible during this program. Now, on to our roundtable. We're going to start in the most obvious place in the world, and that is the primary campaign. This long national campaign isn't over yet. It's going to be heading here to California soon, which appropriately is the land of Hollywood and virtual reality. But before we get to California, of course, we've got a New York primary that takes place this week. And I want to throw this to Carla to get us started. What do you expect to happen tomorrow in both parties?
Well, I mean, this is going to be so fascinating because New York is a big one. I mean, for Hillary Clinton, let's start with the Democrats first. For Hillary Clinton, I think New York is a chance to reset. She's had this a couple of weeks where she's gotten bad headlines, and Sanders has just come up on her doing these fabulous, huge rallies, making so much hay about the fundraising. Here in San Francisco, you may have been stopped by the motorcade on Friday when she came through. The protesters were out front. George Clooney came out and engaged with the protesters, at which point they called them a corporate shill. And then they said, even worse, they said, "And you sucked as Batman." And he said, "They got me there." She's been faced with these headlines that the money she's raising is obscene. Meanwhile, Sanders is doing these $27 average, and raising more than she is. Sure. So, okay, New York is a place where she's been reelected twice as senator. She knows this turf. She's doing a lot of very small events, grassroots events, while he's doing the big rallies. And, the polls are showing she's 10 points up on him. So she's going to come out. There's 45, I think, somewhere around 40 superdelegates at stake there. She's expected to get most of those. She's already, I think, around 700 ahead of him if you count the superdelegates. So by most accounts, I mean, this is a very narrow, if not disappearing, path of Bernie Sanders, but I think he's going to go all the way to the end. I think he's done an amazing job in terms of turning out people. But boy, that debate in Brooklyn, oh my gosh, to watch that, it was like a WWF.
You're watching all these people. How many of you saw the debate?
Yeah. Did you watch this? Some of it was cringing. I was cringing watching these two go at it with each other. But a lot of Democrats said, hey, this is a healthy contest. They're going to get over it. We'll see. It seemed a little bit. On the other side, we just have to talk about Trump.
Sure.
When you're talking about double digits ahead of Ted Cruz, this is his place. He's doing so many events; it's just unbelievable and crazy. And I think this is another case. 95 delegates at stake there. He could come away with most all of them, if not all of them, because the polls show him getting over 50%. And under the rules of the New York primary, these are close primaries on both sides. If you get over 50% in any congressional district, you win the whole thing. And then you win more if you get 50%
on the Republican side.
Yeah. So for both Trump and Hillary, this looks like a win. And it looks like for Donald Trump, a place where he actually, if he comes out a winner in New York, and then he's next week is another Super Tuesday primary. You're looking at Pennsylvania, other Rust Belt states. He actually now could have a very narrow path when you count California to that 1237 that he
needs. So wait, even to having the votes before the delegates before the convention.
Yeah, he may be able to swing this. And he's hired people in California. He's getting it together when it
finally
comes. Finally. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Right.
When it comes to the strategy part, which he hasn't been good at. I mean, newsflash, Donald Trump, the system is rigged. I mean, that's his message. And that's been going to be his message going into Pennsylvania, New Jersey. They're rigging the system. The establishment doesn't want me to win, and that is stuff that fires up his people. So, master of marketing. No,
at the same time, he has to win over those superdelegates for the second round in this process. So he has to be very careful not to alienate them in talking about how rigged the system is. And
because they can go away in the second round.
Yeah, that's a delicate balance.
I have to say this, and I have to pat myself on the back for this. It might have been our last program or the one before that. We were talking about how the delegate system works with the Republicans. I think this could be with both parties. I don't know. But I asked one of our panelists, there's no rule against a candidate just buying the delegates, right?
That's right.
$1 million, vote for me. I think a lot of people would suddenly find themselves amenable to voting for him.
No, yeah.
Today, Donald Trump, check this story out, Donald Trump is saying, oh, you know what? I've got lots of toys that I could share with these delegates.
It's true. I just talked recently to Sal Russo, who founded Tea Party Express, who told me that Paul Manafort, who Trump has hired to sort of engage this whole system to get things going, he's a big lobbyist. He knows this whole game backwards and forwards. It's going to be out there offering these people, you know, memberships to Trump golf courses, trips on Trump One, you know, front row seats to whatever. It's totally legal to do that, and Trump has a bank account to do it.
I would just say, look at it logically. Trump and Hillary Clinton should win New York. Those are their places. And yet they consistently do something that is so Trump and so Hillary that it puts them back. And Hillary's, she comes off this debate where she's slammed for taking big money, flies to San Francisco and has this unbelievable gala, okay? That is so Hillary. And Trump has got all this momentum, and yet he keeps putting his foot in it. With the abortion thing, we've got to think about how it's rigged. As everybody in politics is saying, yeah, we know, it's how it works. It's a very difficult system. And by the way, maybe you should have put some people on the ground ahead of time, and now he's doing that. So it plays out logically, at least.
Right. Now, is there something to be said for Hillary on this, this giant George Clooney fundraiser and a lot of the others where most of that money from that George Clooney fundraiser isn't going to her campaign. It's going to the DNC and to, the down ballot Democrats, the people she's going to need in Congress if she gets elected.
I'll just say this, which is, I don't know if you saw the interview with George Clooney on Meet the Press. But, I mean, does that guy look like a candidate to you? I mean, he's just amazing. He's just an amazing interview. He's so into politics. And he pointed that out, saying, this money, yes, is obscene, but I'm doing this because I got to raise money for a Senate and a House. If Democrats are going to win, that's what I have to do, like it or not. And it is a criticism that has been put at Bernie Sanders. Like, where are you raising money for the Democratic causes? Yeah. He hasn't.
And this is part of Bernie's problem is he's not playing the insider game.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, these delegates have no loyalty to Bernie. They are hostile to him because he's never done anything for any of them except for the handful that he's named. So this is a real problem is by definition of being an outsider, independent from Vermont who caucuses with the Democrats, he by definition doesn't play their game. Yeah. Hillary is deeply embedded in the game and there are many relationships and loyalties. So it's going to be really difficult for Bernie Sanders to pull these people away on a personal level of a sense of loyalty, I think, to Hillary Clinton in the long run, even though Bernie's logic is, we can change the game by changing, what happens going forward. And he's counting on California. I mean, he is making California, the primary in June, more important than anybody. He thinks this is where he can surprise the world.
What do you think his chances are here?
Not good, but
really?
But
yeah.
But I didn't think they were good in Michigan either.
Yeah.
And I didn't think they were good in Massachusetts either. I didn't think they were good everywhere he's lost. I didn't think they were good. But it's also true that Bernie Sanders is winning on day of voting Democrats, so people that show up on the day of. Hillary Clinton is actually winning older voters who are sending in by mail-in ballots. So right now, New York has already started, I think, at the end of March, started in the mail-in balloting. So Hillary's already probably won New York based on those voters alone. And then you have to understand that Bernie's main constituents are not allowed to be a part of this primary in New York or in California with closed primaries. Bernie can't win New York and California.
He doesn't have the independence.
He can't win. As much as he has made amazing inroads, and I agree, I'm so impressed with Bernie Sanders' campaign, the structure and the substance. But he just is running out of the capacity to win.
Bernie has won.
Yeah, he basically, I mean, the idea that he was a long shot, he's been a long shot from start to finish. And we thought that all along, that the Democratic field did not have as many candidates as it should have. And the fact that we're still talking about, you never know, you might pull it, that's really amazing. Yeah. And the way he's moved the needle with her is really amazing. And he doesn't want to be an insider. He isn't playing the inside game. He's playing the outside game. But I think he knows that. And even though he's losing, he's winning.
We should point out, too, in California, if you're a declined estate voter, you have to request ahead of time the Democratic ballot or the Republican ballot. If you cannot vote on the Republican side. You have to re-register as a Republican.
Right, yeah.
But if you want to vote on the Democratic side, you're going to have to request that ballot ahead of time. And May 23rd is the deadline on that. So just don't let that go by. Because in New York, as you said, a lot of these younger voters, either they've never voted before, they're showing up expecting to register. Yeah. Trump's own kids didn't know they had to register to vote.
I mean, part of Bernie's problem is he's got all of these sort of what we call hangers-ons. You know, people that will show up because of a crowd. But he's got 27,000 last week, 28,000 today. How many of those people are actually going to show up tomorrow? And that's the challenge that Bernie has, is to get the 28,000 enthusiastic people to show up, not just show up to hear the speech, but show up where it counts, arguing and debating and caucusing or actual voting in the primary.
And none of this would have happened if Hillary had been a more compelling candidate, which is what she's fighting to do.
Had been a what candidate?
A more compelling candidate, I was trying to say. And that moment in the debate when Bernie Sanders challenged her again on the transcripts and she backed off and refused to hand the transcripts of the speeches she gave to Goldman Sachs. And David Brooks said the other day, you know, she has this personal tick where she hangs on to something until it damages her the most, and then she hands it over. And that's what she's going to do with these transcripts, I'm sure. But that's the thing that hasn't happened. It hasn't changed. As long as we've been sitting here telling these stories, is Hillary remains not a compelling, not an emotional, not a visceral candidate, and Bernie Sanders is. He's all that stuff.
It wasn't just in the debate that things kind of got testy. There's been, you know, the surrogates, you know, what was it, a month or two ago, we had on the Hillary Clinton side, Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem said things that, you know, basically if you're a woman, you're not voting for Hillary, there's something
special
wrong with you.
Special place in hell.
Yeah, special place in hell. But actually, Madeleine says that about everybody. So that wasn't. But anyway, I mean, more recently now, we've had some of Bernie Sanders' surrogates. There was the phrase, corporate democratic whores.
Yes, that was, yes.
Tell us about that.
What? Dr. Paul Song, who was the executive director of the Courage campaign, major advocacy group here, and well-known in California, made a reference to corporate democratic whores at one of the big Bernie. And, you know, a lot of women, hold on a minute, who are you talking about? He said he was talking about Congress in general. But the fact is, he resigned today from the Courage campaign.
Oh, he did.
He did, and he's a very big Democratic fundraiser too. A lot of Democrats who use him. Mike Conda is one of them in Silicon Valley. He just recently did a big fundraiser. He's being called upon to return those donations. So this is where it's not just a candidate now who has to worry and be freaked out about the YouTube moment. It's all the surrogates involved.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it's important, I think, to note also that I think today it came out that there's a national poll, which, again, political scientists don't pay these any attention, but a national poll that says that Bernie Sanders has become, within the statistical margin of error, almost tied with Hillary Clinton. But again, it really means nothing.
Especially since most of those states have already voted.
Yeah,
so.
Right.
And isn't this the year that we've started to feel like our polls are not that effective?
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like these polls have well reflected what's going to happen. Yeah. And I wonder if a lot of it isn't, let's just throw a crazy idea, but maybe it's cell phones, because you can't, you're ending up calling a lot of people on landlines, or maybe older voters and so forth. Maybe you're not getting a good picture, I really have begun to doubt the polls.
We saw that in 08 and 12 when Nate Silver came out, you know, on top, because everybody else was wrong. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we go right back to the normal, and then we'll trust the same people that screwed up royally, because we don't know whether Rasmussen is better than the CBS poll or, you know, whatever the different, you know, entities are. So the rank and file pedestrian American doesn't know the difference between the best and the worst polling. So they're all over the place. And
speaking of worst and polls, what did you think about the polling that showed, this was national polls, about what people thought about Donald Trump, as well as the other Republicans? But I mean, the numbers on Donald Trump were like north of 70% of people despised him.
I mean, I'm not
even saying that to make fun of him. I mean, those are staggering numbers.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. I think it sort of reflects what his strategy has been in the past 2 weeks. He's been on his best behavior. He has not done a lot of crazy news conferences. You know, he was supposed to come here to California and do a big news conference. He canceled that. Right. He's been now getting the strategists together, and he's coming here next week. From a news junkie like myself, I can't wait to see this speech at the Burlingame Hyatt. You know, he showed what a marketing genius he is, I think, because Kasich, it's a Republican convention 3 days next week. You've got Kasich speaking on Friday night. You've got Cruz speaking on Saturday. Donald Trump came in and is doing the first speech. He cuts in front of all of them and says, I'm going to do Friday lunch, which what does that mean? All the media, we are going to be all over him like a cheap suit and writing about what it means. He's going to get the lion's share of the attention in California. Yeah. And, these polls about his high negatives, it's so interesting because it doesn't stop people from coming out. They turn out for him. And this is where Democrats, I think, have to worry.
I just think these people who are showing up in these crowds for both Bernie and Trump are just not going to show up when it matters. I just think that they're exercising whatever it is they want to express now. And instead of when they need to, which is when these count. And I think that's a problem, is young people don't vote. You can look at from the moment when young people were given the right to vote in the 1970s, there's been basically the original jump around the Nixon election or the Ford election, should I say more accurately, and then it's flatlined for the last 40 years.
I don't know.
Say that again. I missed it.
I said I took Eugene McCarthy all the way.
But you know, with Obama, the perception was Obama or Rand Paul. There's this amazing youth effect. Obama's effect was flatlined, like everyone else's, of the past 40 years. So young people get all excited. They get behind Rand Paul. They get behind his dad. They get behind Obama. They'll get behind Ross Perot. They get behind John Anderson in 1976. They'll get behind anything that's new because of what's so unattractive about what we have. And then they realize, after they pull off the lid on Obama, it's the same. They pull off the lid on Ron Paul, it's very different, but, you know, too different. I was going to keep on going, but I would have run out of gas. Stop there.
Well, last week I was speaking with one of the advisors for Bernie Sanders, and she was talking about how bringing in all these new voters and, you know, keeping them engaged, and how that's, you know, there will not be the 2 year later collapse like we had, where, you know, the Tea Party came in and took Congress and such. And I said, well, that kind of sounds exactly like what we heard from the Obama folks in 2008. Yeah. And of course, it didn't happen.
But it's a little like San Francisco politics. If you go to City Hall on some of these issues and somebody musters 300 people for public comment, you think, holy cow, this is a movement here. This is going to happen. I mean, and then we have a vote and it gets gobsmacked. So, I mean, you think, what the heck's the deal? And I do think Trump is starting to wear on people. I don't know if you saw Dick Cavett called him Trumpo, the incredibly unfunny Marx brother. So I think we're starting to see a little backsliding on that.
And we're starting to see other reporting on him that has more personal tone. The Boston Globe over the weekend did a real look at sort of Bachelor Trump back in the 80s, and I was like, this is not a pretty story. The picture is him, Mr. High-Flying, surrounded by all the beauties of the pageant with, like, cleavage all over the place, and it's, like, not a presidential-looking.
Right.
And that is just, to me, the beginning of those kind of stories you're going to see.
And I think there's a cumulative effect that you can just sort of feel the impact. Trump is not hot right now, and I think that happened in September, we forget. From September till November, until I think it was San Bernardino or Paris, whichever happened first, mm-hmm. Donald Trump had flatlined for 2 months straight. And Ben Carson overtook him for September, October, most of November, and then he crashed predictably in December. And I've been saying the whole time, he's going to crash by December. And my only reference is what happened to the other black guy who ran the previous time, Herman Cain. He crashed in December. That was the basis of my intel. Well, the brother didn't make it before this one didn't make it. So I just, that was easy to predict.
That's good.
You know, so here we are.
You know, on the converse, I don't know if you saw it, but there was actually an interesting story in Politico about Hillary Clinton, and this was by a reporter who had covered Hillary Clinton when she ran for president in 2008, but then ended up covering her when she was Secretary of State and traveled with her and so forth. And he said they were two different people. The candidate is stiff, is difficult, is defensive. It's very hard to break through. But the Secretary of State, the person in charge, the person who's actually administrating, was not only effective, but she was popular with her staff. Right. She was well-liked. And it makes you wonder...
Yeah.
Is the political process really a good way to find a good person to handle these jobs?
The point of the story was once she had the job, she was really great and shined at it.
Yeah.
But getting the job, she really was not very good at it. And that is one thing Clooney said, too, in this interview. Asked why he was with her instead of Sanders. He said, hey, Darfur and the Sudan are very big issues with him. He does nonprofit stuff, a lot of activism. And he said he worked with her at length as Secretary of State. He knew she knew that issue backwards and forwards. And that is sort of one of the issues. I think she hasn't been really good at articulating what she did as Secretary of State. You hear people say all the time, well, she was a do-nothing secretary. No, I mean, she traveled quite a bit around the world. She really did meet with a lot of world leaders on key issues like those. And
Which is why you wondered, Bernie Sanders calls her unqualified. As she said, you can call me a lot of things, but unqualified is not going to be one of them. She's held almost every job, I mean, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah.
So I think it makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Question from the audience. With Sanders pushing Hillary to the left and Cruz seemingly pushing Trump to the right, which of the four, if elected, would be the most apt to move to the center?
Hillary.
I think Hillary.
I'd say Hillary.
I think Hillary.
But that's what she says her commitments are.
Yeah.
The centrism of the DLC.
That's right.
And that was the theme of the debate. She said, basically, it's easy to talk about the problem. It's far different to attack it or to actually address it.
Sure.
I think her other line is, I'm not going to make promises I can't keep. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's all goes mm-hmm. to the issue of who can actually deliver once they get into office.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, another thing from that article was that, you know, the Flint, Michigan water crisis, when that came up, Bernie Sanders reacted as a populist politician would. He called for the resignation of the governor of Michigan. And Hillary sent two of her aides to Flint, Michigan to see what could be done. And they said, what you could do is help free up these funds that we can't seem to get this thing done. And as the mayor of Flint said, I can't say she did it, but that is what eventually happened. So it's the difference between, you know, playing to a crowd and actually being an administrator who does those kinds of things. I still don't find her compelling. I still find her appealing, but I think there is something to be said that she could be a very good administrator.
Heading into back to the California primary, I guess, how many delegates do you think Trump, Cruz, Kasich, so on the Republican side, how many do you think they would get in the California primary on June 7th? So, wow. I mean, not specific numbers if you don't have, but I mean, who ranked them?
So you got 172 at stake here in California. The polls are showing that John Kasich has a very good shot at getting some of the Bay Area. I know the Kasich team is looking at trying to get maybe all nine Bay Area counties, and I think it may be possible. So a lot has been written about the fact that Barbara Lee's district has like five Republicans in it, and you can get those three delegates as easy as it is in Orange County.
That's right.
They count. Where are you going to campaign?
And they count the same. Yeah,
they count the same.
They count the same. So there's a lot of strategy going on. We're looking at where these candidates are stronger. Trump looks stronger in the Central Valley. Cruz is was just recently in Orange County, really campaigning there. That looks strong for him.
Yeah.
So I think Cruz on the strategy side, and this is where his people have been really, really smart. They've been working it. His chair, his national spokesperson, is the former head of the Republican Party here in California, knows every one of those delegates who's going to be there next week at that convention. He's going to get a big blowout reception. And you know that Ted Cruz will be out there meeting all these people. Yeah. And that's what it's about. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Are they going to hold? Yeah. Are they going to hold for Donald Trump going into the second ballot of that convention? And most of the feeling is, you know, he's going to lose most of them. He's got to win on the first ballot, or it's over. You can get the ball up to the 1 yard line in football. Yeah. If you don't get it over the line and get that 1247, it's wide open. Yeah, it's wide open.
And apparently, Kasich and Cruz are banking on this negative strategy of just denying Trump the actual numbers. And so they're not trying to gain anything except to keep it
to get it to a second ballot.
So they're actually in a campaign against Trump in mathematically. And it's going to take whoever has this, you know, the policy wonk types, the math, you know, the math heads around who can help figure out mathematically what it will take to deprive Donald Trump. I was listening to CNN on the way over, and they were describing a scenario where without Rubio, Cruz becomes more important. Mm-hmm. Kasich becomes very important outside in the West Coast. Kasich needs to win in places where Cruz just cannot win, because Cruz is trying to stop Trump. He can't in certain places with his Texas evangelical conservatism.
Right.
And so he needs Kasich to win in those places where he can't appeal for the same purpose. So he temporarily needs Kasich right now to help him win where he can't win, or help Trump not win where he can't win, if that makes sense. So again, they're conspiring against Trump, trying to prevent him from gaining points by taking points back.
What's interesting about Kasich is the national polls are showing him the only one
who could beat Hillary.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet he's struggling in his own party.
But that is my question, and that would be my question to the two of you, is, I get the fact that we're trying to keep it from a first ballot nomination, but what does happen with the second? I mean, I never thought we'd say the words of the reasonable alternative Ted Cruz. I mean, is that really what we're going to say? I mean, is he the prohibitive favorite on a second ballot, and is it really going to be chaos?
Yeah, I'm not good at analogies, but I'm sure there's a good one that talks about the choice between poison and a gun. something like that. There are plenty of them out there. You all know better than that. Whatever two bad choices, equally bad choices you can come up with, is what the Republicans are facing, unfortunately for them, going forward in this campaign. But they have right there waiting for them somebody who I think can win moderate, who can win independent, who can win liberal votes. And that's John Kasich.
And that's what Kasich's strategy is. And he's got, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah. He's got Steve Poizner, former insurance commissioner. He's got some big Republican names. And I think you're going to see there's a lot of well-known Republicans in the state's been written about who are saying there is no way I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about people like George Shultz, we haven't heard from him yet, or some of these really elder statesmen of the party. They're going to be asked this, and who are they going to cast the vote
for? That's a good question. I mean, George Shultz was attacked in one of the debates, wasn't it, in the Republican debate? And it was one of those kind of jaw-dropping moments. It's like, if the Republican candidates are attacking, you know, one of their major elder statesmen.
And we talked about it last time, how Shultz was front and center the day Hillary gave her big foreign policy speech at Stanford.
No, that's what they're going to need more than anybody to help repair the Republican Party is the elder statespersons. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, Nancy Reagan is gone. But they need those kinds of high-profile people to say, okay, we've been through this. We've done this before. Let's come back together. Let's land this thing well, and let's compete and unite.
And does it make more sense maybe for those elder states people to actually be staying out of it rather than getting muddied up right now because all the momentum is with the extremes so that they can play a role?
Being elders, I think their job is to sort of sit back and wait and see how this plays out and then exercise wisdom that the rest of us say, okay, now somebody reasonable is speaking about this process.
That's when they can be the parent and say, I told you.
Because the Democrats already have it built in Barack Obama as president. Yeah. They have it built in.
Right.
The Republicans don't have an equivalent to Barack Obama right now. George Bush is not it in terms of the electorate.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really have George Bush. The father might be. I'm just trying to think of different people.
And a lot of their sort of elder statesmen are saying they're not going to go even to the convention. Yeah. I mean, this is going to be fascinating to watch. I mean.
And yet there's something in me as a political scientist that thinks that this is such a wonderful thing in general, that this system needs a good shaking up that Bernie and Trump represent. But, of course, the fear is we don't know where it lands and how it lands, so the unknown leads you a little bit afraid of it. But we do need this kind of disruption of the system because it has gotten so vulgarly corrupt. in terms of the, you know, the money aspect, the Citizens United aspect that Bernie and others are campaigning against. You know, it's sort of the reasonable, you know, person in the American electorate has to be alienated from the money in this process right now, because it's sort of going in places we don't really feel like we can still control as Democratic citizens.
When you like that, though, see, when you like that, we call that rooting for the story, James. Yeah. That's, we like to have a good story. That's what we want to do. Yeah. But yeah. When we move from this moment of the circus of the delegates of the system to the actual voters in the United States, now I go back to my idea about the polling. Is Kasich really a better alternative for the Republicans than Hillary Clinton, than anybody else to defeat Hillary Clinton? And I don't think we know that. And we've had this confusing, long mud wrestling match. You know, and talking about the elder statesman, you know what they say about the mud wrestling matches? You don't want to get in a mud wrestling match with a pig, because you both get muddy and the pig likes it. So those two candidates are perfectly happy to do that. You want to get involved in that or not. But is there any chance that Ryan would come back out of the...
No. He's already said no way.
Well, but the fact is... He's said it before.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's true. But I think he means it. I think the Kasich strategy is a Hail Mary pass, just... And it could... happen, I think. I mean,
because the delegates will get to the convention and say, let's go with the guy who won one state.
Right. Yes,
at least we know we'll get Ohio.
And see, that's another problem. Again, I explained this last time. There's a rule of eight where each candidate, in order to be considered in the open brokered convention, you have to win eight states.
And but Kasich, that rule could change.
Kasich has not won one. Now, if they throw those rules out on the floor, that's different.
Yeah.
But right now, Kasich is not qualified. Only two people qualified to be in the bag are Trump and Cruz, because they both have won eight states. So before we talk about 1272, we have to talk about eight. And Trump and Kasich has only won one. So he technically, unless they somehow violate or change the rules, is not even eligible right now.
Right now he's not.
But that nicely ties in with Ted Cruz basically saying, yes, I need Kasich to be in there because there's no way he can be a threat to me, but he can still be a blocker for
That's the interesting thing. It's really not about the voters anymore. It's all about the math.
That's right.
It's all about the math. It's all about the strategy.
Okay. Well, we went into this a bit. Someone asks, is this election the best argument for public finance of campaigns? Money is buying the process. Policy is not.
Every election is the best argument for public finance.
Yeah. I mean, when you see, there was a story this week about how 50 Americans are really responsible for, I think, 90% of the super PAC money. The number one being right here from San Francisco, Tom Steyer. I mean, it is so weighted now for these ultra-rich voices that something has to be done. Whether anything, we hear this every time we go to events, in every 4 years, and nothing is ever done. And I don't see anything ever happening on that, do you?
No. I mean, because it's a money system, and the court has determined, not just in Citizens United, you can go back, it's 100 years. People said it was 100, Citizens United overthrew 100 years of body of law. It's not true. Citizens United confirmed 100 years of the notion that persons or entities like government agencies or corporations, excuse me, is what I'm struggling with. Corporations are actually persons. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the 14th Amendment that was aimed around giving personhood to the Africans who had not been considered such. And what came out of that immediately is a group of cases called the Slaughterhouse Cases in Louisiana that gave the equal protection under the 14th Amendment to capital, to property, not to people. So this is not, Citizens United is not unprecedented, is my point. Citizens United is consistent with 100 years of American law that sees property and money as an articulation of a political preference and will. It's opinion. You have a political voice, and if you were blessed with more money, more power to you.
Literally.
Also on this ballot, of course, and someone in the audience actually asks about this, so they ask what propositions on the ballot and how that might impact the turnout for the primary. There aren't any hot button. I mean, this is not one of the...
Only one statewide.
Right. Is that Prop 50?
Prop 50, which
state,
is...
corruption?
That's right. Thank you, Leland Yee.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of where this one came from. you had three all Democrats, senators...
Shrimp Boy.
Yeah, that's right. Leland Yee being the marquee name. But, you know, even after they had been indicted, you're still collecting salaries, still collecting benefits. And, right. You know, the political establishment up in Sacramento was, well, we can't do anything. That's just the law.
But I saw something on marijuana legalization again and law enforcement brutality issues. I saw two.
Are they trying to get on?
Those are for November.
Okay.
So in June, there's only one.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And I think this is an important one. I mean, having seen the three senators come up and continue for months to get their salary and benefits, this is sort of a no-brainer, I think, if I may.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you mentioned somewhere in there police. So let's talk a bit. There's been a lot, of course, about, I mean, this has been for months that we've had issues of police reform and prison reform in the news. Chuck, I want to start with you. You've been writing quite a bit about this lately. Can you tell us a bit about where we are right now in this and where this might be heading as far as policy or no change?
I think this is one of the most difficult issues I've seen in San Francisco in 30-some years I've been here. It's really, really goes to the culture of the city and the culture of police and the culture of law enforcement. And I really think that on every side, people are genuinely trying to come to some conclusion of what could make this better. And in the midst of it, unfortunately, we have gunfire and we have death. And I was saying to John and Carla and James, our reporter was the person who got the video of the most recent shooting, the most recent police shooting. And I don't know if you saw it or I don't know if you read the stories, but this homeless man had a knife. He was acting erratically. The HOT team, the home outreach team, said, we can't deal with this guy. And one of the people on that team said that's the first time in 10 years that they'd called the police. Mm. That as a rule, they're very good. They're well-trained. They're experienced. Something was going on with this guy. But if you watch the video, you see the car pull up. The police cars pull up. They get out of the police car. You check the time. They walk over. You can hear them yell, drop it, drop it, drop it. You can hear four beanbag rounds being fired. And within 30 seconds, you hear gunshots. And he's dead. And just among us, this is off the record, but just among us, the reporter who found that video, the resident who had that video, said that one of the people who came over to see it immediately was Police Chief Greg Suhr. And when he saw the video and heard those gunshots, his reaction was, of all the things that he's been trying to do to get this thing straightened out, to have that happen now is just unbelievable. And everyone has an idea. It's the irony, of course, is that we want less lethal means, and yet we won't approve tasers. You know, even if somebody misused a taser, it's got to be a better solution than shooting somebody. We know that's a bad solution. And yet we see in other parts of the country terrible misuse of power and terrible misuse by the police of their rule of order. So I don't know. And I know you guys, we were talking earlier about Chief Suhr. It's funny because when Chief Suhr got the job, I was trying to keep him from getting the job, and now I'm trying to keep him to keep the job. So I can't really. But I mean, I think he's trying, but there is a culture here that is broken, and I don't know how you fix it, but we need to fix it. That's for sure.
Yeah. How is it that, we've had now a number of these incidents, not only that, but text messages, racist messages, and so forth. So much has happened on his watch. He's obviously well respected by a lot of people in City Hall, including the mayor and so forth. And he's a likable guy. You know, you've sat down with him. I have too. Mm-hmm. But how is it that on his watch, he hasn't been fired already, to be honest? I mean, you know, this is a department that's just headline after headline. Yeah.
I've actually had the good experience about in December, USF held a international law enforcement symposium where you had about 300 California Bay Area law enforcement officers, chiefs of police from California and brass and rank and file. And the panel they had me on was Black Lives Matter, False Narrative or New Movement. So it was almost a setup. I'm in a room with 300 cops. And coming where I come from, I don't know how to pretend to be anything other than I am, because I'm not fake. So I was never more emotionally disturbed in 24 hours than I have been at that time. I was just scared to talk. Got up and talked. I don't know what I said. I offended them, but I also told them they were great people, but I also offended them. I'm positive of that. Because half the room didn't acknowledge me after, another half did. So, but it was
that
really
was an interesting. That was an interesting panel, though, because were you there with Sir, or were you there with Delanus?
Sir was in the audience.
Yeah.
Mario Woods' attorney, who works in John Burris's office, yes, was on our panel. Yeah. And Danielle Outlaw, the number two in OPD, she's a chief, a deputy chief. She's the one that brought us in.
Okay.
To
but
organize
this wasn't
panel.
The one where the Police Officers Association, Gary Delanus was there.
No. They may have been there, but this was a USF
thing. Yeah. Sir was very upset about that because he came out in the morning and he thought he had made a lot of good points. And I mean, the text messages, he said that all along. It's unacceptable. You got to get rid of these guys. They got to be out. They're out right now. That's it. As soon as I heard about it, that's it. When they had the Mario Woods thing, he started use of force. He did a lot of those different kinds of things. He felt he'd gone to that USF thing and made a lot of good points. In the afternoon, the Police Officers Association came back and did what they always do, which is, don't you tell me our officers are wrong. These people have a
difficult
job. Which they do. They have a difficult job.
Yeah.
But I know for a fact that there was nothing wrong with shooting Mario Woods. I can tell you right now.
Yeah.
It's the wrong thing to say.
Yeah.
You don't know that.
Yeah.
Don't say that. Your credibility is zero.
Yeah.
And I think for the second time,
I have a friend,
I'm going to say, Chief Sir went, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing?
I have a friend that works LASD. He just retired recently. And he was the same way. It's like I would have shot him the same way. I would have shot him. And then he was mentioning, you know, Cleveland. I mentioned Tamir Rice in the same sentence, and he said, which one is that? And I'm just like, oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know who, you know, you said Mario Woods is, you know, deserved his bullets, but you don't even know who Tamir Rice is, who's the little boy in Cleveland that was shot playing with the toy gun in the park, you know.
Yeah.
At least be aware of his name if you're going to take a position like that, you know, to show that you're at least sensitive where you think a person might be innocent. But it seems almost like you said, the cultural issue, it's almost like, my wife is in law enforcement, just so you know, and she was in the audience that day.
Yeah.
And when I got finished, honestly, I was afraid for myself, and I still am a little bit, because I said some things that were offensive, like black people don't riot over innocent people being shot. And that's why I know Michael Brown was probably not a criminal and a thug like he's been projected to be. How do I know? Because I lived in the ghetto. I lived in the neighborhood. I know how the neighborhood works. I know the people in the neighborhood know who the criminals in their community are. Just like you do.
Mm-hmm.
Or don't.
Mm-hmm.
But we know who did certain kind of crimes. We know who were the perch snatchers, who broke in windows. We knew who messed with kids and who did other kinds, you know, who would steal property crimes. The neighborhood knew. Now, if you said Daniel Vaughn, and I hope he doesn't hear this, if you said Daniel Vaughn messed with some child in the neighborhood, nobody would believe you because that wasn't his rep. But if you said somebody's house got broken in today, everybody would say Daniel Vaughn is at it again.
Mm-hmm.
And the community is not going to riot for Daniel Vaughn, but the community will riot for innocent people. Latasha Harlins in Los Angeles. The riots in L.A. were not about Rodney King at all. They were about Latasha Harlins. And I was telling people that. I told my mentor that at USC in a class called Urban Politics. He's a black professor who just died recently. We were in Urban Politics. It's 91. The tension is out there. I'm a graduate student on the ground in USC and in LA. And I'm telling him, I said in class, Dr. Preston, there's going to be a riot tomorrow. There's going to be a riot. And he embarrassed me. The only black kid in this class, he's black. Everybody else wasn't. He said, James, sir, there's not going to be a riot, and just dismissed me. So the paper was due April 29th, 1982. Make a long story short, I called him and said, Dr. Preston, I can't turn my paper in today because there's a riot going on out in the streets. And he apologized to me for the rest of his life because there was just, you just know that when you look at Emmett Till in 55, it was about his innocence. And the woman who we whistled at just died in 2014, for the record. Few people don't know that. You look at L.A. 92 was about Latasha Harlins, not Rodney King. Rodney King was beat March 31st, 1991. Nobody rioted when Rodney King was beaten. They reacted to just Judge Harlins removing and giving Soonja Du community service for shooting this girl in the back of the head in a scene that was very similar to Mike Brown getting into the tussle at the store, if that was him at the convenience store, and she shoots Latasha Harlins in the back of the head. What very few people know, and this is a sidebar, is that the Korean community in Los Angeles formed great solidarity with the black community in Los Angeles. If you look up something called Sa Ai Gu, which means April 29th, in, I believe, in Korean language. It breaks down the strong support that Korean community showed in Los Angeles for the black community. And they had a massive march, but the national media only showed a few shop store owners with their guns at the ready shooting at African-American looters and vice versa, as opposed to all of this humanity that was going on off the scene. And so my point is, I think when you think about these emotional outbursts you see, ask yourself, why did they react that way? Listen to this. There were 1,000 shootings of unarmed people in America. About 700 of them had a weapon, but they were used, most of them were self, you know, trying to hurt themselves. I think there were about legitimately 95 people who had weapons that they shouldn't have had that were threats, and the police shot them. Out of 1,000, they shoot 95. Black Lives Matter has marched maybe 7 times. They had about 900 other opportunities to march if they wanted to and burn down cities, but they did not. We can name the handful of cities that Black Lives Matter has actually targeted, largely because of the innocence of the people on the ground, where they see clearly that the person was not armed or a threat. I assure you, tomorrow, if the police shoot another innocent person, you will get a reaction. But if they shoot a Rodney King, if they shoot a known criminal, the community will say that, you know, because they know who the neighborhood is. They know the wisdom of the streets. That person was up to no good, and he probably deserved the death he got.
Or you gotta wonder if the person is homeless or considered mentally ill.
Right.
Then does the police get a pass on this? Right. I don't know.
I think the use of force thing is going to be. One thing we can say, I think, is that these beanbags are a waste of time. You know, we've got this idea that we've armed these guys with these weapons that are going to... I mean, Sir said, after the Mario Woods shooting, he said that the cop that was on the side, if you've seen the video, Mario Woods starts to walk, and there's a cop who moves over in front of him. And he said, the way he put it was, if we had a calendar in the police force of most buffed officer, he would be January. That guy is huge. And he said, I said to that guy, why don't you just hit him? Why don't you just take him over? And he said, because they just hit him with a beanbag in the crotch and it didn't have any effect at all. So I can't hit him any harder than that. So I don't know what else to do. So I think the step between a beanbag, which is ineffective, and stop, 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 drop it, drop it, drop it, which is ineffective, and 19 shots, there's got to be a middle ground somewhere. Yeah. Well, I think so, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I think. But we want it both ways.
Right.
Well, and people, I mean, it sounds crazy, but I keep getting emails of people say they used to shoot nets at people or throw nets over people. Or especially with an edged weapon. I mean, it's very hard. And we had just said time and distance. We're going to treat these cases with time and distance. And it was 30 seconds. You know, now that, you know, it's unfortunate that we don't have the video of what the guy was doing. The police say he charged him. Witnesses say he wasn't. I don't know. But that wasn't time and distance. You know?
And the other issue is, isn't there a way to stop him, even with a gun, you know, kneecap him, whatever, but don't, you know, 17 shots. Do we need that?
Yeah. See, but
why
all,
is there no middle
the
ground?
The police officers I know and the peace officers I know, they would tell us that these considerations are not a part of their training.
Yeah. It's true.
Shooting in the knee is not a part of the training.
It's true.
They're explicitly taught shoot
to kill.
Center mass. Yep.
And the threat.
Yep. Yeah. That's true. That's
so,
true.
You know,
so the question is, when did somebody at City Hall say to Greg, sir, we need to have some kind of conversation on this? When is that going to happen?
Well, I think they have. The question I would ask is, okay, let's get rid of Greg, sir. Now what? Because the complaint... When we hired Greg Sir, was he's part of the old boy network. He went to St. Ignatius, played football at St. Ignatius, just like all those guys. They're all the same person. They all show up and do this stuff. The one thing, the wild card with Greg Sir, was that he spent a lot of time at the Bayview Station as captain and was extremely popular out there, really well liked. And they felt like, and he feels like, he can reach those people. But tell me you're not going to bring somebody in from out of San Francisco. I mean, bring somebody in from Cincinnati and say, real quick, get up to speed here. It's kind of a confusing city, but you'll figure it out as we go. I don't think so.
Yeah.
So then you're going to bring somebody up through the ranks, and who's going to be happy with that? So, I mean, I don't think he's saying that, as Gary Delanis is, and the Police Officers Association is saying, there's nothing wrong with what we did. I think he's not saying that. But I don't know if he's going to be able to get his arms around it, and he may not survive. So that maybe that's the sad fact of the matter.
Why not bring in? I mean, L.A., New York, they brought in some high-profile, you know, police commissioners or chiefs or whatever they're called in those areas.
Yeah, even Oakland brought in Bratton, right?
That's right.
Well, yeah. If you could bring in Bratton, that'd be great. But, I mean, that's the question. Is can you bring in someone that really has a new vision and, by the way, can interact with a police commissioner that's going to yell at you about we need to use less use of force, but you can't have tasers? You know, I mean, it's very difficult to figure that out. How exactly, what are the dynamics of that?
Okay, we had a program last week, I think, with Van Jones and I don't know if you were familiar with it. It was about Cut 50 or hashtag Cut 50. It's a plan over 10 years to reduce the prison population by 50%. This is addressing what's called, you know, the mass incarceration nation, basically, that we have. I guess anyone on the panel, does this have much of a chance? Is there momentum behind efforts to reform? You're shaking your head.
I think there's a lot of political will. I mean, Jerry Brown took the initiative here in California and eliminated the grand jury and the police shooting of civilians. And that may have been a concession to Black Lives Matter, but he also eliminated the solitary confinement at Pelican Bay and the other state prisons, except for the ongoing violent offenders. That wasn't a concession to Black Lives Matter. So my point is there's an openness, I think, right now, at least out here, for activists to be able to influence new policies. But I don't know how far that, you know, how far and widespread that will be in other places, because the issue of mass incarceration is not a national problem. Technically, if you really break it down, the real holding of people in prison are at the state level, right? So it's an issue of federalism. Yeah. So the national government, I think, has 175,000 people in holding out of 7 million. So it's not a national government problem. Obama can only do so much symbolically at his level. How do you get the governor of Georgia, North Dakota, South Dakota, New Mexico, Nebraska, Kansas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Delaware, and Missouri, and the rest of the slaveocracy or ex-Confederacy to actually make these adjustments into a post-mass incarceration society? There's no political will or political reason why they would change that.
But do you think there's been at least the start of a national conversation on this? Because I have heard Hillary Clinton and Bernie talk about this. When you talk, particularly, you know the stats, 59% of the incarcerated are people of color. There's a real understanding that we incarcerate more people than any other country on earth. The costs are huge. A lot of these are for-profit prisons.
But the president can say in the name of states' rights, I have no power here. Talk to the governor of Arkansas. She can do better than I. I can't do anything. Jerry Brown has done an effective job, if I'm not mistaken, in reducing the population of prison inmates in California and has decentralized them to the local county level.
Well, that was under court order, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So that's where you need the change. Basically, Black Lives Matter, I would argue, needs a 50-state strategy and other groups that are into prison abolition or whatever language they want to cause. But a national remedy is not the solution. It's a state level, state-by-state strategy you have to use to be successful in undoing the 50% population. So unless he's talking about this happening in blue states only, I don't see how that happens.
Those governors are not going to do it unless their constituents are behind it. And look at the campaign we're in now. We're in a campaign of fear, which is, you know, people are out to get you. You're going to have to stop.
And the one phrase
exactly
I would leave, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Stevie. The one phrase I would leave you with is that characterizes our politics at this moment is political polarization. This side doesn't talk to this side. And this side is only talking to this side, so you hear each other talking, and there's an echo chamber effect where you actually think you're right, but you don't talk to this side. You all only talk to each other, so there's an echo chamber effect. You don't talk to this side, so you think... So there's a book by Bill Bishop, a journalist out of Texas, out of Austin, called The Big Sort. Anybody familiar with this? He says we're basically self-sorting ourselves out by ideology, not even by race, but the liberals are only talking to liberals in our politics. Conservatives are only talking to conservatives in our politics. And then we see that at the national level. So Congress is really mimicking the electorate. And it goes back to your original point. The prison, the mass incarceration is an extension of the electorate. Donald Trump is an extension of the electorate. This is the part we don't want to recognize. Yeah. There's a study you can look at right now that was just published by Stanford University, two psychologists, about 8 months ago. Anybody familiar with this? This study showed, and this is really devastating, that if you expose liberals who are white in San Francisco specifically and New York and nowhere else, just those two places. Anybody familiar with this study? That if you expose them, please Google this, if you expose those whites in New York and San Francisco to the realities of mass incarceration, disproportionate minority impact, all of these things that show the 59%, all of these issues, 2 million black people in jail, Latino impacts, women impacts, the impacts on children, please be clear that this study from Stanford psychologists just showed that it actually, in California, in San Francisco and New York, actually strengthens support for harsher punishment. Really? When you expose white liberals in San Francisco and New York to the realities, the brutalities of the mass incarceration system, they actually say, with some, these are based on cues, but you have to look this up based on cues, push a button, see what you see, push a button. You see a black person in chains, does that bother you more or less? And they interpret what that is supposed to mean. But their conclusions are subject white liberals to the realities of black and brown, people in the mass incarceration regime. And it doesn't lose any support. It actually gains support for harsher treatment. Stanford University published that about 6 months ago.
That's really interesting. But you know what does, I mean.
And I wonder what that is.
That's fascinating. I'm not aware of the study, but I see that they're now bringing up, for instance, the impacts of the 1994 crime bill, yes, or Bill Clinton's being called on the carpet for, and has put Hillary in a tough situation. And Bernie Sanders has had to say, well, they also had the Violence Against Women Act, and there was other things in it. But they're, I think for the first time, America's kind of looking at this, at the long-term impacts. Yeah. And you're right.
And
it's on
devastating.
States level.
No, there's
but
a book,
it's a state. Yes,
there's
you're
a
right.
book that two colleagues and I wrote. It's called Something's in the Air: Race, Crime, and Marijuana Legalization. And we cite some criminological research that explains that if the war on drugs was stopped today, cold turkey, it will still take another 80 years to undo the impact of the war on drugs on black American life. So this is permanent. The impacts, and so we're talking 60, 70 years from now if they stop today. And Obama did what he could with the, 100 to 1 crack cocaine to regular cocaine grams, the 100 to 1 gram ratio. They reduce it now to 18 grams to 1 gram of crack cocaine. That will get you 5 years in prison. There's still a imbalance, regular powder to crack, but it's not as bad as it used to be 100 to 1. So again, as much as, we all have good intentions, there's some kind of psychological effect that may be not, the NIMBY, not in my backyard. Look, I'm sorry you all have to deal with that reality. That's your reality. Fix your family situations. We got busy. We're busy trying to deal with our own realities.
I'm kind of wondering if the white liberals looking at that, it subconsciously is saying, oh, there must really be a problem there.
Yeah,
it's fear.
It's
fear, don't you think?
Exactly.
I mean, that's kind of the deal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also watch out for unintended consequences, because we did Prop 47, and that was a good idea in theory, which was too many people are incarcerated because of drug crimes that are actually very minor. Mm-hmm. But with that, we also decreased from felony to misdemeanor some property crimes. And our results, we know in San Francisco, is runaway car break-ins. And I had a cop tell me that they caught a guy, and he broke into the car, and they got him red-handed. Took him into the station, and they turned him over. And the last thing that guy said when he turned around was, I'll be out tomorrow.
And
he was.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's tricky, but
we've got to move along. I do want to get one more topic. First, since we're kind of talking about, this is a different topic, but we're still kind of talking about legacy of laws and such, someone does ask, shouldn't we be demanding a reinstatement of Glass-Steagall and prosecuting those responsible for the financial crash, noting that, when we had the savings and loan crash, they say 1,000 people were prosecuted. Does that have traction anywhere other than with Bernie Sanders folks, or is there a possibility that, for example, if Democrats take one of the houses of Congress, we could see some legislation or anything?
No. I don't see that.
Although I did say last time I was here that there's a scenario where the Republicans could lose control of the House, but yeah. I don't know if that's going to happen. But Donald Trump has definitely put it in play.
Yeah, I don't see.
Okay. Well, I did also want to talk about, I'm sure, been seeing it almost every day, another big company or band that's canceling appearances in North Carolina over a bill that it passed that basically struck down local anti-discrimination laws regarding LGBT folks, and one of the best-known provisions. one of the most infamous provisions, requires people to use the bathroom of their birth gender. In other words, forbidding transgendered folks from using the bathroom matching their current identity. The governor recently was trying to
rework this one is just
modify.
But
this is only one law. I kind of want to do two things, if we could. One, just kind of talk about how this is a movement. There are a number of states that are doing this.
Yes.
South Carolina now is considering
one. There was an attempt in California to do this as well.
California.
That was an attempted ballot measure, which failed. But the fact is, this idea of passing laws to command transgender people to use certain bathrooms as if there's some kind of crime wave going on with this. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling. And
especially when we have Republican leaders being arrested, like Dennis Hastert for raping baby boys.
Thank you.
This is one of the this was the consensus guy after Livingston, who comes after Newt Gingrich for morally, judging Bill Clinton, who's no friend of mine. But they impeached this man on moral issues, and all of them from Henry Hyde on, all of them, thanks to Larry Flint, were exposed as morally, corrupt individuals. And now we see Dennis Hastert was probably the worst of all of them because he's not involved in a simple adulterous relationship. He's victimizing young boys.
Yeah. No, exactly the point. And the other sort of hypocrisy is the Republican Party, which talks so much about local control, keeping big government out. These laws all specifically banned local governments from passing their own anti-discrimination laws, and also took away the rights of citizens to sue. Right. At this point, so many artists and companies, PayPal being Bruce Springsteen, Ringo Starr, you can name the list. Mm-hmm. Did they not learn the lesson of Indiana?
I think it's not only them. I think this is the problem with living in a bubble, because I think the governor thought to himself he was going to do something that was going to be perfectly reasonable. And the way he came across after he signed the law was, well, the people are in favor of it. I think he's astonished to hear that Bruce Springsteen isn't, but I'll bet he's also astonished to hear how many people in the United States are also feel this way. And it's the problem with not having a bigger picture. And especially with LGBT issues, this is a case that those values have moved so quickly that they're leaving a lot of people in the dust. And it may be there may be a short-term victory for those people, but they're not going to win this.
Yeah, and
this
it's
is
not,
headed the other way.
No, and they've been having marches in North Carolina and in fairness, North Carolina, it does have a strong liberal tradition in North Carolina. The Tar Heel State has a strand of liberalism going back. V.O. Key, who's the foremost student of Southern politics, wrote about the liberal traditions. Of course, it has others, but there are liberal traditions in North Carolina. And I think those are also being highlighted as well in this, is that there are liberal voices saying, please don't judge all of us here in North Carolina by these few people who've made these policy recommendations. Understand that there's a silent majority of people who may not endorse these issues, but definitely are not in support of discrimination.
Well, and you're certainly seeing that the larger cities there they're the ones who had passed these laws that you do have very liberal.
My question is, and I'm sorry to jump out of my seat, but why do these? Oh, so Black Americans invest millions of dollars. They made Nike what Nike is. Michael Jordan. I'm old enough to remember it was Converse and Puma, and there was no Nike until about 81, 80, right around 83, 84. Then Jordan got it in 85, 86 and took it to a whole new level. But my point is, Black Americans made Nike the corporation it is today. And in all of these police shootings, none of these corporations have come out to say, we will not do business in Minnesota, Cleveland, Baltimore, anywhere. None of these companies. Nike actually went out of its way to have a law enforcement day during the shootings. And there was nothing in Black America, no leadership, no mechanism, no default reaction, self-protection, that we will not support Nike anymore. I promise you, when you walk out today, you'll see Black kids wearing Nike and you happen to have our Nikes in the front row. See, I have a bunch. I went and bought 3 pairs of Nikes this week for my kids, so I'm a hypocrite. I'm a hypocrite too. But my point, and that's what my wife said, you're talking all this talk, but you're buying Nikes, but that's part of the dilemma, right? But why don't these corporations, why do they choose certain issues? This is really interesting to me. Yeah. The one group, and tell me if you disagree with me, the one group that Donald Trump has not attacked openly is gay people.
You know what I think?
And I wonder if it's because it's not safe. I wonder if it's because it's not safe, the way you can talk about the immigrants or talk about the blacks or talk about women generically. But if you target gays specifically, would there not be a backlash? I'm wondering, is that why he's not touched it?
You know what I think?
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of time. Is that what you're going to say?
No, they have money.
Yeah.
They have money. This is an oppressed minority. They may have problems, but gay people in America are successful in a lot of cases, and they donate to campaigns. They are players in politics. This is not a group of people that is not in the I think in their own way they're powerful.
Yeah.
I think they're becoming less threatening, but they have definitely gotten into the political game. They're not sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah. And these corporations are being responsive to that, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
So as we saw in campaigns, as we saw in Glass-Steagall, as we're seeing everywhere else, it comes down to money.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, listen, it's time we get to our news quiz before we wrap up for the night. Fran is here. She'll be our prize deliverer person. Is that the correct term, I think? Scientific term. For those of you who have not been here before, let me briefly explain what we do. I'll ask a question. If you think you know the answer, please raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. I'll call on you, and if you're correct, Fran will deliver unto you some Ghirardelli chocolates. If you do win, by the way, please then sit on your hands and let someone else win. Okay, first question. Speaking of basketball, what former basketball great endorsed Hillary Clinton this week? I saw your hand behind there. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, that is correct.
Did he?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Just yesterday.
Suddenly James is like, I might have been wrong all this time.
I would see him more as a Bernie man. That surprises me because he's very cerebral, Kareem.
Yeah.
And I would think he'd be a Bernie
man.
He's
not a dummy. Okay, next question. Who said that Bernie Sanders supporters would shoot every third person on Wall Street? I saw your hand first. Bill Clinton.
That's
yes.
Right. That's right. I did not hear that.
Right there in the front row.
That's a good one.
Okay.
Did you hear the hot sauce in her purse comment this week with Hillary?
That's right,
no.
These young black kids were on some radio, hip hop radio station. And it's just her and three young people, and they asked her, "Tell us something. You know, you have in your what do you do that we don't know about?" Yeah. And she says, "I carry hot sauce in my purse." That's an old black woman tradition of the South. And make sure you have your hot sauce. So they looked at her like she was crazy. Like, Hillary, really? You're going to tell us that you carry hot sauce around in your purse? And she said, yes. And they said to her, you know they're going to say you're pandering to black folk, right? And she says, ha, 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 ha. Is it working? And I just thought, oh, my God, Hillary, no. But they keep, I mean, Bill Clinton, they are daring black people not to vote for them, but they keep voting for them anyway.
Yesterday.
Hot sauce.
Yesterday, what world leader endured an impeachment vote? Ma'am. In the green, yes. The country?
Brazil,
that's correct. Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, correct. Next question. Name the two countries that had 7.2 or worse earthquake. You know where I'm going with this. Ma'am, in the back there? You, yes. Ecuador and Japan, that's correct.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, we need some good news in here, right? Fans of Canadian Prime Minister, you're all going to know this
Trudeau.
One, Justin Trudeau, were praising him for giving a reasonably intelligent response about what topic that he was asked about. Ma'am, you were first.
Physics,
right. Quantum physics, or quantum computing to be exact.
Viral on YouTube, yes.
Yes, his fan club continues to grow. Who said that his five-minute meeting with Bernie Sanders was just politeness? Ma'am, right there. The Pope, Pope Francis, that's right. Second row right there. Just a few more. What state last week moved to allow guns in churches?
There you go.
Ma'am.
Miss
the great... Really? that's right. Mississippi, right there in the second row. Germany's government has okayed the prosecution of a TV comedian who insulted what foreign leader? And your hand was up right away. Erdogan, right, a Turkish president, Erdogan. It's against the law in Germany to insult a foreign leader. They're moving to change that law, but it's an interesting case to follow. Okay, the United Kingdom has officially named its new $300 million research vessel what? Way in back. Say it again, just because I want to hear you say it again. Bodie McBoatface. This, by the way, is what happens when you let, like, everybody vote on a name. I think after Bodie McBoatface, the Scottish referendum, and now the EU referendum, I think the British government's going to stop asking. We got this one. We'll figure this one out ourselves. Okay, one more question. That one's too easy. You'd all know that one. Okay. This past weekend, world health agencies began what they hope will be a final push to eradicate what? Don't say Donald Trump. Ma'am? Sorry? Polio. That is correct. Very good. Raise your hand again so Fran can see you. We are nothing if not NPR audiences here. Listen, we're going to be back with more news quiz questions and, of course, much more to discuss on Monday, May 16th, right here in San Francisco. You can find our week-to-week news quiz every week on Huffington Post. Thank you to our panel, Dr. James Taylor, Carla Marinucci, Chuck Media. Thanks to all of you for coming out today and everyone listening and watching us online. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.